Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. You don't know crap about stalking, okay? So just knock it off. Sorry. I want to thank Polly for the invitation to be here. It is a real honor and a privilege. I want to thank Lori for being my hostess, and Marilyn and Carol, who made me feel welcome as well. It's a real honor and a privilege to be here. You know, I mean, you got eight speakers, seven alcoholics, one Al-Anon. Really, good Lord. I mean, it's like, I'm not afraid of the odds, you know, not at all. So I'm actually outnumbering the alcoholics, if you want to know the truth, but because I have all my brain cells for one thing, and just a fact. But I tell you, all those brain cells can be a big hindrance to me too. Let me tell you, so it's not necessarily a blessing. But it is an honor to be here with them. They're fabulous. I know so many of them. I have personal history with a lot of them. And you're really blessed because you've got the cream of the crop here without a doubt. And I love them all very much. And it's my pleasure to be on, you know, the same program with them without a doubt. I do have to, you know, everybody's given a beautiful talk. Katie's needs a little help. You know, I don't normally bug people about going to Al-Anon, but Katie's got to go. She's got to go. She's got to go. And another thing she said, I just want to make an observance of, just an observance, you know, about the sexual prowess of alcoholics. You only hear that in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, okay? I'm just telling you that. Men or women, it doesn't matter. You know, it's just like, yeah. And as the recipient of alcoholic prowess for over 40 years, it ain't that great, okay? So I'm just telling you. So, see, in Al-Anon you learn good sex is when the other person receives as well, okay? Yes, we have to learn that here. Anyway, before I digress too much more, but it's been wonderful. I've had a great time, and I love being around women. I have always loved being around women. I love women. I just do. I have two sisters, and I grew up in a family. You know, my dad didn't like having girls at all. Girls were bad. Girls were insignificant. Girls could be easily replaced, blah, 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 blah. And I love women. I always have as a little kid. I've always gravitated towards them. I feel my most comfortable around women. I feel loved by women. I've always been nourished and encouraged by women. And so I am so, so pleased to be here at a women's conference, even though there are a couple of people that have somehow lingered in here. But we're going to forgive him because he really wants to be a girl, okay? We all know it, so... And why wouldn't you want to be? I just can't imagine being anything else, you know. I've seen guys how they operate. God, what a lot of work. It's just it's so much more fun just to me to be a woman, and I'm very grateful to be here with you guys. But anyway, I'm just going to – it says in there – you know, I got a couple – on one thing it said I was supposed to talk about forgiveness, another thing her story – you know, and if you want to know what my story is forgiveness. I mean, it's just what it has really been about me, and it's not just about forgiveness of the alcoholic. It's about forgiveness of myself, and it's just, you know, and that ability to forgive is a direct result of working the 12 steps, without a doubt. When you're in Al-Anon, you have to work the steps, too. You know, there's no just topic meetings. I know it sounds fun and all that, but if you're really working an Al-Anon program, then you are working the steps, and you're working them with a sponsor. You know, because, you know, self-reliance, boy, I know how to do that. You know, what I am really, really good at is faking it. I am just wonderful at it. I know how to act. I'll do exactly who you want me to be, how you want me to be. And that's why a sponsor has always been so important in my life. Because she's the one that chose me. I call my sponsor the truth teller. You know, know, that's just what she has absolutely been for me. And because of that truth, you know, I have a chance and an opportunity every day to have a shot at a good life if I so choose to take it. Because that's all the program gives me every day, is the shot at a good life if I so choose to take it. And, you know, like I said, I'm the oldest. I have two sisters, and then I had a little brother. But basically, it was us three girls. We were pretty much in succession, right in a row. And, you know, and Sonia, I want to thank Sonia for singing so beautifully. I mean, it really has. I do want to say thank you very much. I'm sorry you had to sing the sad song for I Came Up. Okay, thank you. But it's the truth song as well. You know, it's absolutely the truth song as well. And, you know, and sometimes being around women's conferences is a little bit difficult for me, especially when there's a lot of women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And not because I'm uncomfortable around you. I am not. I love you guys. But, you know, I had a sister die of the disease when she was 32 years old. And she was sober for a while, a few months, or you know, maybe 6-7 months or something else like that. And then she went back out again, and that's the one that she died behind. And I miss her every single solitary day. And sometimes I see some of you who look just like my sister. And even though, as Sonia said, you know, it's, you know, I never think of her as gone. She's always with me. I'm still the oldest sister. So I'm in charge, you know, and that's never going to change. When I get to heaven, the first thing I'm going to do is kick her butt because she didn't listen to me in the freaking first place. And that's another thing I want to say, you know, the F word, okay? Al-Anon's invented that word back in the caveman days, you know, because when that first drunken caveman walked in there, walked back into the cave, I'm sure that his wife was like, what the, you know, I mean, what else can you say? That's the only word that describes that behavior sometimes. It's like you have no other word for it. But I miss my sister. I miss her a lot. And you know, she had a handle on it, but did she really have a handle on it? I don't know. But you know, she paid that ultimate price, and I miss her every single solitary day. But like I say, I know she's with me all the time because you guys have taught me that. And I feel her through you. I absolutely positively do, so thank you for that. But anyway, I'm the oldest. I got two sisters and a brother, and we grew up in a military house. My dad's a master sergeant in the Army. He rules us, our family, like the Army, because that's just what my dad does. And like I say, he doesn't like having girl children, very upset about that all the time. But he treats us like we're in the Army, and we have bunk beds. We have little Army bunk beds that my dad stole from the Army, you know, and we have Army blankets on them, foot lockers at the end where we stole our gear. You know, it's folded in a military fashion the way it's supposed to be and all this stuff. And we have our shoes that are lined up under the bed. Not that we had that many shoes, but what shoes you have. And my dad would come in and do room inspection, you know, and stuff, pop a quarter on our bed. And I loved it. I love all the order. I love rules and regulations. I like knowing what you want me to do, how you want me to do it. I think I really... That was a way of life that just resonated with me. It still does today. I can still make a bed you can't get out of once you get into. And I know when my husband and I were first married, he just like lay in bed like this. Oh, no. Don't you kick your feet. And lightened up a little bit. And still, you know, I can still, like I say, make a pretty nasty bed. But anyway, I grew up with this dad, all this military stuff, all this, you know, rules and regulations. My dad was big on corporal punishment. I mean, you did the crime, you got it. And my dad was big on the belt and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not saying any of that stuff really scarred me or did anything, because I don't know anything. When you're a little kid, you don't get a manual about what your dad's supposed to do or not do or whatever. I just grew up with, this is the way, this is what's going on, this is how it's going down. This is how everybody's family is. And why should I not think any different? You know, we always lived in military housing with other military families. There were lots of moms that were walking around with black eyes and broken arms. You know, it was no big deal. It's just what happened there, you know. And people hit each other all the time. The MPs were always showing up all the time. So for me, that was just normal behavior. That's just the way it is when you're growing up in a house like that. You know, and what I learned early on, though, too, was that I learned not to ask questions. Because when you ask, you know, when you ask the dad questions, you ask the Sarge questions, and he doesn't want to answer those questions, he doesn't want to hear those questions, you'll find yourself on the other side of the room. You know, so you never know when a question is going to be okay or not okay. Because I don't know my dad's drunk and not drunk, because that's just the way he is all the time. So I think that's just what dads do. Dads drink, and then they get drunk, and that's just part of being a dad. And then moms get their arms broken, or they get black eyes or whatever, and you get slugged around, and that's just the way that it is. And I seem to see that all around me, so I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. Absolutely not. I thought, again, you know, being a girl child, not a good thing, but you're stuck with it, you know. So you do the best that you can. You try to make the Sarge proud. You do good in school. You get straight A's. You do, you know, do all those kinds of things. And again, just what I was brought up with. You know, what I know today is because I do need answers because I want them. I want to know what's going on, but I can't ask questions. So I learned early on that, you know, I just make crap up pretty much. You know, when I don't know what the answer is, I don't know to ask because I've been, you know, I've been hardwired not to ask. You know, just figure it out for yourself. So, you know, I call it information from nowhere. It's floating out in the universe, lands here, becomes fact for me. I need an answer and I will think one up. And it'll be pretty good based on the reason that I have. But just based on the reasons that I have, and growing up in an alcoholic home, there's not a lot of really fact-based anything going on there. And what I'm grateful for today and what I learned in Al-Anon is I got a lot of misinformation from a man who had a lot of misinformation. That's all that got passed on to me, was just a lot of misinformation. And if I don't make it any bigger of a deal than that, then I can deal with it and I can move on. You know, I'm sure it's just like, you know, back in the old days when everybody believed that the world was flat. You know, until Columbus went around it or whoever it was that got the credit for finding out the world wasn't anymore. But, you know, and that's just kind of how it was for me when I came into Al-Anon. I learned that all those things were not true. And that was a huge freedom for me, and I'm very grateful for that as well. But anyway, you know, my dad was just a mean guy, just to cut to the... He was just a very, very mean guy, and he was angry drunk. Oh, my gosh, just angry, angry, angry. My dad was not the happy-go-lucky guy at all. He was mean to begin with, and then when you added alcohol, he just got meaner on top of it. And I don't know where all that came from. You know, I know that both my dad's parents were alcoholic. You know, my grandmother died in her apartment of cirrhosis of the liver. My grandfather died frozen to death in his car because he's drunk one night in Ohio and froze to death because he passed out in his car. You know, I know my grandparents raised him. I know my grandparents, or excuse me, my dad's grandparents raised him. I know that they were very loving people, but again, he was affected by, you know, their behavior and all the things that happened to them. My dad also went into World War II when he was 16 years old on a Navy submarine chaser, and he was, you know, injured in battle. And, you know, and I know all of those things happened, but you don't know all of those things happened to somebody when you're a little kid. You have absolutely no idea. My dad never spoke of them, but he was just really angry. And when he, you know, so when he drank, we just learned to hide out. Just don't go there. Stay away. Don't have anything to do with it. And, as I got older, you know, it just got progressively worse. I tried to, do everything my dad wanted me to do because I wanted my dad to be proud of me. I absolutely wanted him to be proud of me, you know, because he was really big on a lot of things, duty, honor, country. Those things have been pounded into my head. You know, loyalty to family, just all of that stuff. And I learned a lot of good things, I think, from my dad there. But all of it, as the disease gets progressively worse, got more skewed, more skewed, more skewed. And anyway, like I said, I was always the good kid, straight A student, you know, do exactly what the Sarge tells you to do, do it exactly how he tells you to do it. You know, talking about growing up in an alcoholic home is always kind of difficult. If you've grown up in one, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And, when I was really new in Al-Anon, I went to lots of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still do. I can't recommend it enough to people that are new in Al-Anon. It says in our literature we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism, and I know no better place to learn that than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one night I'm at this one of these first meetings, speaker meeting, and the speaker talked that whole night about alcoholism, the family disease. And he described it basically, he said it's like having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And if I have to describe the house that I grew up in, boy, that's exactly the house that I grew up in. You know, and to give you an example of that, you know, my mom would know, like, when my dad was going to have one of his alcoholic explosions, but she could never say to us kids, okay, nobody talk, nobody do anything, because your dad's going to blow, because then, of course, my dad would blow. So earlier than expected. And but if you've been at the dinner table and your mom speaks to you facially, then you know what that means. You know, when you're at the dinner table and there's, you know, I mean, that's not an epileptic fit. You know, that has real meaning. And you know, everybody knows, don't talk, do nothing, shh, quiet. You know, but if you have an alcoholic that wants to explode, nothing is going to stop that, never stop my dad. You know, and you could do some minor infraction, scrape your knife on the plate, spill a little bit of milk, boom. You know, my dad would go nuts, dinner would go flying, everybody would get a whooping. You know, everybody's got to go to bed. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We all got to go to bed. My mom, the kids, the dog. It's just the way it goes down in our house. And the next morning I get up the courage to go in the kitchen because I got to go to school and get some breakfast. And I'm creeping down the hallway and I go in the kitchen and there's my dad drinking his breakfast beer. You know, and it's, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? And no one ever says, gee whiz, what was that about last night, Dad? Gee whiz, how come you had to hit everybody? How come you had to break everything? Because the rhinoceros just goes back to being a coffee table again, and you hope today will be different. You know, and that's going on right now, this very moment, in more houses than I can even begin to imagine. This very moment. Because that's the family disease of alcoholism. That's just how it just keeps going on and on and on and on. So, like I say, you know, my dad was just this really very, very, very angry, angry person. My dad died. My dad died when he was 55 years old. He died the disease that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, total insanity and death. I can't even tell you the last words my father said to me. They were so vile and so vulgar, I wouldn't even begin to repeat them from this podium. You know, and I would say the last words my dad said, when in reality, what I know today, it was the last words my dad's alcoholism said. Because when my dad died that day, I tell you, there wasn't a dad in there. There wasn't a person in there anymore. It was just totally, the ugly disease of alcoholism had totally engulfed this whole entire person. That's all that was there, was just that hatred and anger and resentment and just all the awful things that go along with it. And I would like to tell you that, you know, by then my mom had divorced him, and I'm the oldest, so I have power of attorney for his health and all of this stuff. And I'd like to tell you that when the doctors came out and told me and my sisters that my dad was dead, that we were like sad and, you know, and just, you know, a family injured and hurt, but we weren't. My sisters and I were like, ding dong, the witch is dead, da da da. You know, and I don't tell you that story because I'm proud of it. I tell you that story because that's where the disease of alcoholism takes a family. That you would be glad that someone was dead. You would be glad, just because for us the reign of terror was over. Because my dad was always going to kill us, and he was always going to do this to us, and, you know, and he hurt us a lot, you know, and we took a lot of beatings behind my dad, and I don't want to make it sound like anything worse or whatever. I mean, it's not like he didn't break our bones or anything else like that. He broke my nose a couple of times, you know, stuff like that. But again, in an alcoholic home, that just becomes like, oh, it wasn't that bad. He just broke my nose a couple of times, you know, and this is how we become sick too, where that becomes acceptable, where it's not as bad as. You know, again, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism. But worse for my dad was the verbal. I mean, my dad was a master sergeant in the Army. He could rip your skin off without putting a finger on you. And that was the worst part of it all. And so my sisters and I were thrilled. I mean, it was just like, yay, Dad's dead. Woohoo! And I had been coming to Al-Anon. My dad died Friday, October the 13th, because my dad would die on Friday the 13th. That's a day he would pick, because he was real big about being the devil and the devil's spawn and all that kind of crap. All drunken ballyhoo talk all the time. But anyway, he was really big about that. So he died. And I started coming to Al-Anon June. Of the same year that my dad died in 1981. And so June to October, I'm not even close to the loving and kind portion of this program by any stretch of the imagination whatsoever. But I want you to know, you know, that when my dad died, my sisters and I really believed that it really was over. It's done. Let it be over. Go away. We don't have to live this way. We don't have to live in fear anymore. And even though, you know, at that point, all three of us were married. I mean, I got married at 19, and I was the oldest. One of my sisters got married at 16, the other at 15. Everything was just to get the heck out of that house. But we really had thought this reign of terror was over. And it wasn't too long after that, not even a month or so. You know, and what we got to discover was that, you know, the alcoholic had died, but the alcoholism was alive and well, living in all three of us. All three of us. I mean, the family disease of alcoholism didn't die and go away that day. Just the alcoholic. That's all that had happened that day. And how I got to find that out is because, you know, as time was going on, you know, it didn't matter. I did a lot of work about all this stuff. I did all the writing with my sponsor, all the step work, everything that I was supposed to do. But it didn't matter. I would think about the things my dad had said to me and done to me, and boy, I would just get so pissed all over again, just so angry. And I don't know how you are, but when I'm really pissy and angry, I like to take that home and share it with my family and the people I love and care about the most, because isn't that what they're there for in the first place? And I wasn't happy about doing that, but I didn't know how to stop it. You know, I didn't know how to stop it. And I remember discussing it with my sponsor once, and she said, you know, Larsine, we know what the problem is. We absolutely understand the problem. She goes, but Al-Anon isn't about a problem. Al-Anon is about a solution, and we got to work on a solution. So she goes, I'm going to give you an assignment, and you're not going to like it. Because I never like any assignment they ever freaking give me in Al-Anon, because it really seems stupid. My problems are big, and they give you like these stupid little weenie assignments that in some way are supposed to help you get over this traumatic event that happened in your life. Shut up. Good Lord. So, but she said, and her assignment was, is I want you to go home and I want you to think about a good thing your dad has done for you. Oh, my God. And I mean, I'm telling you, how I'm affected by the family disease of alcoholism, that does not exist. That fact does not exist. And what I'm here to tell you today is what I also know from the family disease of alcoholism is that exactly what it wants you to believe. That there is no hope, that there is no choice, that there is no other way to go. That's just the bottom line, the doom forever. And one thing that I've always been grateful for that I believe was God's grace for me is ever since I first walked in the doors of Al-Anon, I've always been willing. Because when the very first meeting, don't ask me why I heard it, but I did. But I heard someone share that if you weren't willing to do something different, how could you possibly expect anything to change? And for whatever reason, that did make sense to me, and I latched on to that. So ever since I've walked in the doors of Al-Anon, I've been willing. It's been about this much, still to this day, about every single salt, about that much every day. But I had that much willingness, and I was willing to go home and think about it. And I don't know how long it took, a week or 2 weeks, and I remember that my dad taught me how to drive. And if you're going to live in Southern California and marry an alcoholic of your own, it's a skill you just got to have. And so and so I remember going to my sponsor thinking, oh, she ain't going to like this. It's not very good. It's not a good answer. She's going to be mad at me. But I sincerely hope that everybody in this room is sponsored as I have been sponsored. And that's by people that want you to do well, who really care about you and love you. And they want you to do well in this program because I have definitely been sponsored. I've had two sponsors since I've been in Al-Anon. My first sponsor, Jeannie, died when I was about 12 years in Al-Anon. And then Carol's been my sponsor ever since. And my gratitude to Jeannie because she's the one who took me through that whole process. But anyway, I go to Jeannie and I said, I thought up a good thing my dad said. And my God, you'd think I'd come up with the cure for cancer. The woman was like jumping up and down. It doesn't take much to excite your sponsor, let me tell you, okay? Any little thing you do, I mean, they are just like all over it, and I know why it is, because when you do good, they look good, for one thing, and it just works, So it's a win-win situation here, okay? So do what your sponsor tells you. You're both going to win on this one. But then I said, well, my dad taught me how to drive. I know it's not the best thing. And again, one more time, she took me down that path. It doesn't have to be the best thing. If that's what you have, it has to be the truthful thing. That's what it has to be for you, is it has to be the truthful thing. And it was for me. And then, what I didn't know was after she gave me that assignment, I didn't know that there was always part two to an assignment your sponsor gives you. Okay, I just thought I was done. No, you're not done. You're getting part two now. And part two of my assignment now was whenever I thought about those things my dad had said to me or did to me or how badly he had made me feel about myself, that I was just supposed to take this negative thought and just replace it with this positive one. Because I do have some power over my life. I do have power about what I want to spend my time thinking about, And she said, another thing, your dad died with all of his children being grateful he was dead, happy he was dead. Do you really need to punish anybody more than that? Is that necessary? And I'm a mother. Do I want to die with my children being grateful that I'm dead? Again, one more time, looking at it from another side. And that's just what happened to me in Al-Anon over and over and over again. Because my circumstances have never changed, ever. But you guys have showed me a different way to look at things. And a different way to look at things gives me hope and gives me a shot at having a good life if I so choose to take it. The circumstances is I grew up with a dad that was very afflicted by the disease of alcoholism. He was a very mean guy. How that might have or might have gone a different way, I have absolutely no idea. But I don't want to live in that. That's not what I want to remember from it anymore. I want to remember a guy that taught me how to drive. Because it wasn't too long after that I thought about a second thing my dad had done and a third thing that my dad had done. Because the family disease of alcoholism never wants you to see anything good that's going on. That just defeats the whole purpose of the family disease of alcoholism. God forbid you should have some hope or happiness or joy in your life. So I'm really, really grateful for that. When my dad died, he was cremated. And like I said, my dad was a World War II veteran. He was a Korean War veteran. He was he's highly decorated, lots of medals. So anyway, when he was cremated, the military brought his ashes to my house because, again, I'm the one in charge. And they brought his uniform, flag, his medals, the whole nine yards. They brought all this stuff to my house. And I was home alone. My husband wasn't there. Kids weren't there. My sisters weren't around. So they leave me with all my dad's stuff. So I took his ashes and I went down to the garage and I put them on a shelf. And I said, you sit here and you think about what you did. He sat there for a long time. I'm talking a long time. Every so often I'd go down there to laundry and go, hey, Sarge, you want to say something now, Sarge? You know, and once in a while I'd pick them up and shake them really hard and put them back down. And all sponsor approved, you know. It's a process. You got to go through it. So just the way it worked out. But anyway, when I was 17, I met my husband. It was really difficult to date in my house because my dad had a lot of rules and regulations about dating guys. We'd bring home these little weenie guys to meet my dad. And my dad was over 6 foot tall, and he had one eyebrow he could raise like 6 inches off of his forehead. I swear to God, he looked like Satan himself standing there. And he would drill these little weenie dudes, you know, where we were going, what time we had to be back, and then what part of their anatomy he would remove if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house in the first place. So it's really hard to get a second date in my house. Like, it just doesn't happen. Guys, you brought your home early. Forget it. They're done. You know, and that's the way I remembered it till my sister reminded me, yeah, Dad was very intimidating, but the fact that he always had a hand grenade or a handgun never helped matters either. But see, one more time, my dad always had a hand grenade or a gun. He was always going to blow up the Helms Bakery man or the milkman or whatever, because again, one more time, that crazy behavior. That was normal in my house. And when you live with it day after day after day after day, it just becomes normal behavior. You don't think that there's anything bizarre about that. You know, I liken growing up and living in the family disease of alcoholism. You know, it's like eating a bowl of crap. It really and truly is, you know, because nobody's going to sit there and eat a bowl of crap, trust me. If you put a bowl of crap in front of somebody, nobody's going to eat it. But I'm here to tell you, if you're living in the disease of alcoholism, you'll choke down a teaspoon of that every single solitary day if there's a chance it'll just bring peace for that moment. You will do it. And that's just exactly how the best way I know how to describe it. Because the bizarre behavior just becomes acceptable. There's no other way, because when it's day after day after day after day. Because I'm living in craziness and I know it, but I have to rationalize and justify why it's okay for me to do that. Why it's okay for me to be here, why it's okay for him to act like he acts and does what he does. So anyway, when I was 17, I met my husband. I should have known there was something wrong with him because my dad liked him right away, and that like never ever happened. I'm going on this date with this guy, and he's my husband is several years older than me. I was 17, he was like 24, almost 25 at that time. And he'd been married once before, had a kid, was back living with his mom and dad, which should have been clue number two to me that there was something wrong with them, but that went right over my head. And another clue they're an alcoholic is they don't wear underwear. Just in case you're wondering, just putting that fact out there, okay? It's just out there. I don't know what it is about two pairs of pants that's so hard for them, but something is. So put that in your little notes there. Help you avoid a terrible decision. But anyway, we're going back to his house, and we're with this other couple, and we stop at a liquor store, and he asks me what I'd like to drink. Well, I'm 17 years old, and there's rules and regulations in the state of California, and I'm a rule and regulation follower. I don't drink. It's against the law. And I proceed to tell him the rules and laws of the state of California and that I am an underage minor, buddy. And I know he heard what he still hears today when he doesn't want to hear what I'm saying. He heard blah, 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 blah. Because he went in and got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing else, to impress me about his wine knowledge, I guess. I don't know. I don't know anything about any of this stuff. And I don't drink. I don't. And so anyway, we go to this house and we're going to play this game. And it's a legitimate board game. It's called Pass Out. I don't know if you guys have ever heard about it. I read the rules. There's rules in there. And so... But in order to win at Pass Out, you have to drink. Okay? Now, I have a lot of rules and regulations. I've got an index, Rolodex thing in my head. You know, I've got an index card for every situation that can happen on the face of the planet. Okay? Because I'm a checker-offer. I love checking stuff off. I like to do it. I make lists all the time. You know, at the end of the day, when I check off that last thing, that's an orgasm for me, folks. I'm just telling you. I am all over it. I will put crap on my list that wasn't even on the list if I did it, just so I can have something to check off when I'm feeling insecure that day, you know, whatever. Because I like it. It's what works for me, you know. And what I've learned in Al-Anon is there's nothing wrong with being that person. There's nothing wrong with being that person. You know, as long as you be that person and you don't make other people be that person. And that's the deal for me. Just because it works for me doesn't necessarily make it work for you. You know, but what I've learned is that I grew up with a lot of order and I'm comfortable with it. I like things where they go. I don't like having to search for things or find things. That's an instant, you know, mess for me. But when I keep things orderly, it's comfortable for me. And so I found that, you know, way to make that kind of system work. So, anyway, I've got this Rolodex in my head for everything because, again, I like to check things off as they go. Now I'm going to play a game, and it requires drinking. It's against the law to drink. But I have another rule that I have to win every game I play. You know, and when you have as many rules as I do, sometimes they will conflict. I mean, and if you're with an alcoholic, you can pretty much bet on it, okay? Because they always change. They're rule changers all the time. And so... So I got to win this game. So I ended up drinking, if I even drank a half a cup of this wine, if you even call it a cup, I guess you call it a wine glass, whatever it was in. Anyway, if I drank a half a glass of that wine, you know, I won the game, and that's what that was all about. And you can guess who drank all the rest of the wine, okay? But what I remember about that day to this day is I remember what a good time I had, how much fun I had, how much fun he was. Without a doubt, it was just like, it was the most freeing experience I'd ever... My life is so regimented up until this point. So regimented. And now I'm with this guy, and he's just fun and easy and laughing. You know, and now I've got an index card in my life about what my life is going to be. Let me tell you. You know, I'm 17 years old, and I know what's going to happen to me. You know, I'm going to get married. I'm going to marry somebody who loves me, who's loving and kind and fun, you know, and never gets mad. He's going to want all-girl children. We're going to have, like, 9 girls, you know, because that's my big thing. You know, and one of the things on the list is he is not going to drink. Because I'm 17 years old now. Boy, I know what the problem is in my house. You can cut the hate in my house with a knife. That's the house I'm in, and I am not going to live in that house when I get out of there. Now, here I'm going out, and I can't wait to go out with this guy again. I got to go out with him again. But there's the drinking thing. That's on my list, and this guy definitely drinks, and he drinks a lot. But I, too, the non-drinker, how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, will rationalize and justify whatever it is I need to do in this head of mine. You know, and again, information from nowhere. I just think it up, lands here, becomes fact for me because I decide. You know, this is the difference, though. This is why it's okay for me to go out with him. Because, see, when my dad drinks, he just wants to hit you and beat on you, make you feel bad about being a girl, make you feel bad about who you are. You go out with Butch, he just wants to hug you and kiss you and tell you how pretty you are. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I can work with that, okay? I mean, it just has great potential written all over it. You know, it's just, I can mold this to where I need it to be. And we pretty much dated exclusively from that point. It was really, really hard to date Butch, basically because he couldn't remember my name. But you can't let a little thing like that stop you from dating an alcoholic now, can you? I mean, that should just be the tip of the iceberg. And my name is weird. It's Larsine. My dad named me Larsine. You know, and like I say, my dad was not happy about having girl children, very unhappy about having girl children. And he was very upset because I'm firstborn and he couldn't name me after him. So he named me Larsine, which he told me was the name of a town in Scotland. And my dad was proud of his Scottish heritage, very, very proud. He was very ashamed that I was a girl, but the fact that I was firstborn, I got this special dispensation. I got this name, which he told me is the name of a town in Scotland, and I should always be very proud of it. I've always been very proud of it because he told me to be. I've been raised that way. I'm very proud of my name of a town in Scotland. My dad's now long dead. I'm in Al-Anon a while. This is before freaking laptops and computers, and when you wanted information, you went to buildings called libraries, okay? And so I go to the library to look up Larsine, Scotland. You know, I'm about 3 or 4 years in Al-Anon at this point. And I can't find Larsine, Scotland, but we just have a little library, a little Redondo Beach library. So I go to the reference librarian who's there and ask her to research it for me. And, you know, she tells me, come back in 2 weeks and I'll get you all the information I can. I come back in 2 weeks. Nope, no such place as Larsine, Scotland. It doesn't exist. And, you know, and now I am very pissed because I've already done all this work with my sponsor, forgiven my dad, and here's my dad from the grave. You know, one more time after me again. And so, but then I have this friend in AA, he's a golfer, he goes to Scotland every year, because I guess it's the golf mecca of the universe there, and he says, you know, maybe there's not Larsine, Scotland now, but maybe there was Larsine, Scotland many, many, many years ago, you know, thousands of years ago, before you fly off the handle, let me go check it out. He goes back there, comes back 2 weeks later, no Larsine, Scotland, never existed, you know, so this is, I am pissed, I'm changing my name, screw my dad and forgiveness, and I'm done with it. And I happen to be with my husband at his AA big speaker meeting on Saturday night, and a good friend of ours walks up to me, and he says, Larsine, I found out that Larsine is a Scottish word. I am like, oh, my God, you're kidding me. What does it mean? He goes, it is Scottish, for father was drunk when daughter was born, so daughter got a weird name. And Now, that is probably not true, okay? I'm almost positive of it. Please don't Google it, okay? Just don't even go there. Leave me alone. I'm over it. But what he went on to say to me that was even more important was, he goes, Larstein, I'm alcoholic like your dad's alcoholic. And I believe that whatever your dad did, however he read it or wrote it down or wherever he got it from, you know, that he believed it was the name of a town in Scotland when he gave it to you. And just because the gift isn't wrapped the way that you think it should be, is it any less of a gift? You know, one more time, I bring it to you. You show me a different way to look at it. You know, attitude is everything here. And thus, I get the shot at a good life. And though my name in reality still means nothing, you guys have shown me a different way to look at it, so now it means everything. You know, and that's just what happens here, time and time and time again, when you come. You know, I hate it when people say it's a self-help program. Self-help damn near killed me. I don't know about you guys, but I about self-helped myself right into the friggin' ground. So, and it's not. It's about taking it. It's about, because I don't think right. I am hardwired to think negatively. This is where I've grown up. This is what I know. Think the worst. Always go there. I always go to the dark spot. But I bring it to you, and you guys show me a different way to look at it. You know, and what ended up happening is Butch and I dated for a few years, and I ended up getting pregnant. I don't care if it's a big deal for you. It's a big deal for me. Later on, when our life got really, really bad behind the drinking and using, I was sure it was because, you know, I'd broken the big rule and the big regulation from above, and this was the big punishment. You know, I had to come to Al-Anon a while to find out if you're going to screw around and not use birth control, you might get pregnant, just a fact of life. But God, isn't it so much easier to blame God? You know, it's just so much easier to pin all that kind of stuff on him so you have an excuse for being miserable and unhappy. You know, and that's pretty much just that whole process that I went through. You know, and needless to say, you know, getting married, having kids, all those things that you think will fix the alcoholic, you know, that will make it different, you know, didn't make it anything. It just got worse, and it got worse and progressively worse, just like our book talks about. You know, and my husband, you know, as much as I knew that he tried to do the very best that he could not to drink. You know, I know every time that he told me that he promised me he wasn't going to drink anymore, that he meant it with every fiber of his being. I absolutely, positively knew that. But I didn't know that it was alcoholism. You know, I didn't know that once he took the first drink that there was no more promises, there was no more nothing. You know, I want you to know that Butch and I got married in a church. We got married in front of a minister. That I loved him, and I know that he loved me, and I believe we were as sincere as any two people are when they get married, that we wanted to love and honor and cherish each other and take care of each other. But what Butch didn't know and what I didn't know was it wasn't Butch and Larstein that got married that day. It was also the family disease of alcoholism. And I'm here to tell you the family disease of alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything or anybody. And it means to tear your family apart through the alcoholic or the non-alcoholic. It's totally irrelevant to the family disease of alcoholism. You know, and it just, you know, it just got really bad real fast in a big, 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 big hurry. And nobody was more shocked about it than me, because I really believed that love would fix it. If I just loved him right, it would all be okay. And I remember the first night he didn't come home all night long. And this was like 3 days into our marriage. Okay. Now, up until this point, I'd never discussed with Butch his alcoholism or his drug use or any of that. But the day after we got married, I did tell him the rules and regulations of the marriage. Because I thought he should know, you know, and he, you know, and he did this, which I took as affirmative. You know, what I know today is he's so freaking drunk and loaded, he's just doing this thing, you know, because then he heard the blah, 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 blah part. And I know this because, like I say, 3 days into our marriage, he doesn't show up all night long. And this is a huge violation of the rules and regulations I have sat down. And anyway, he comes in the house and he demands, you know, like, waking me up, demanding to have his dinner. It's like 3:00 in the morning. And then, you know, so I scurried into the kitchen, but then I woke up fully and I remembered who he was dealing with. And I'd made this Mexican casserole that I'd called for one jalapeno pepper, but I had a whole can full of those suckers in the refrigerator. So I just chopped up every single one of those suckers and stuck them in there. And he ate the whole thing. His mouth must have been on flame and fire. You know, and then he's doing what I want, and that's in the bathroom puking his brains out. Now, I don't know how you are, but when my alcoholic throws up, I just get a warm feeling all over, okay? I mean, it's just like, it's the best. It's absolutely, positively the best. You know, and again, one more time, lack of knowledge. You know, but this is where I take it right to the beginning. It instantly becomes a war. This is a person I love. I'm married to for 3 days. And this is where alcoholism took us in no time flat. It takes precious, precious love, precious hope, precious promises to each other, and just turns them into dust right in front of you. And I don't even know it. I know I love in our literature where it says how we become nervous and irritable without knowing it. Why? Because we try and force solutions. You know, and it was just these kinds of things over and over and over again. His drinking, me trying to stop him, me hunting him down, him hiding, you know, me getting him on antabuse, me, you know, just everything, trying to fix something that I have absolutely no idea. And nobody to talk to about it. Nobody to talk to, because a couple times I mentioned at work what's going on in my house. You know, and people look at you funny. Why would you put up with that? Why do you stay? You know, they don't love an alcoholic. They don't know what that's about. So you learn to lie. That's what I learned. You know, that's just how the family disease of alcoholism told me, is I just make up stories about what's going on. And that's how I'm affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I'm not even the person that's drinking. You know, and it just gets progressively worse and progressively worse. And, you know, towards the end of my husband's drinking, we were supposed to have a family reunion, his family reunion. And he's one of nine kids, so it was a big deal. So I made him raise his right hand and promise he would be there and be sober that day. And guess who's so drunk and so loaded they can't even freaking stand up? And I am pissed. I am pissed off. And I'm here to tell you, no matter how drunk or how blacked out my husband has been, and he's a big blackout drinker, he has never once raised a hand to hit me. It's just not the kind of drunk he is. He just doesn't do that. But that day I was poking him in the chest and I was egging him to hit me. Let's just take it to the next level. Because that's all I know how to do. I'm pushing in the wrong direction, so I just push harder. Just push harder. And all of a sudden I became very conscious. And at that time we had two little boys and they're 5 and 3 years old. And they're standing on either side of me yanking at my pant leg and going, "Mommy, Mommy, please stop yelling at Daddy." And I would like to tell you that I had a moment of clarity then, but I absolutely did not. What I started doing is I started screaming at those kids. How dare you tell me to stop yelling at your dad when he's the reason our life is the piece of crap that it is? You know, by the time I got done screaming at these little boys, I watched my drunken husband walk out the front door. And I, the sober mother, say to the drunken dad, "Where do you think you're going?" And the drunken dad turns to the sober mom and says, "I'm leaving because we're upsetting the kids." And again, I don't tell you the story because I'm proud of it. I tell you the story because this is where the disease of alcoholism took me. And I think I'm the good guy in this scenario. I'm the one with the job. I'm the one holding it together. And again, that to me is like the sneaky part of the family disease of alcoholism. You know, because I don't even know. I can't even recognize my own bad behavior in a situation anymore because I am so justified. I always say that justifiable anger is just as deadly to the Al-Anon as the first drink is to the alcoholic, because there's no room for it. There is absolutely no room for that in my life. I can't afford that. And I'm here to tell you, people will piss you off. We've heard Katie talk about it, you know. But there is. The answer is. The answer's in these rooms. The answer's with your sponsor, you know, whatever. But you let those people rob you. You let them rob you of your peace and your serenity and your happiness when you give it over to them. And there are things that happen. There's absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever. You know, but there is a solution, and that's what I always look to. What is it? You know, what is it that I need to do to take care of myself? That's what Al-Anon has taught me how to do, and I am grateful for that. And I get to let you do whatever it is you need to do, and you got to spin, and you got to do stuff, and you just got to do it. It's just what goes on. You know, my big fear was my children becoming alcoholic. As soon as I found out it was freaking hereditary, I went nuts. I mean, and they're like little dudes, okay? They were like 5 and 3 when their dad got sober. Raise your right hand. You'll never be an alcoholic. Got it? And they're nodding their head, you know, because they do whatever their crazy mother tells them to do. And so we're done, okay? It's like I got a contract here. And, you know, and both of my boys had a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol, tons of it. And the oldest one is doing well, and he's married with a couple of kids, and that's, you know, he's doing just wonderful. And, you know, but my youngest son, boy, just all the time, just a lot of problems with him. And how grateful I am that I was in these rooms. Because what's the worst thing that can happen? They can die. It is absolutely a terrifying thing. I'm kind of skipping around because I want to get to some parts that I want to tell you before I sit down. You know, and one is about having God in my life. And I did not come in here with any formal religion whatsoever. My dad was against church religion. Like I said, he was the spawn of the devil. And that, like, made us automatic spawnettes or something, you know. So, I mean, because that's what he always tells us. I'm going to hell, and you got to go with me because it's part of the package, you know. And, again, when you were raised with that, that's just what you're raised with, you know. I mean, I'm going to hell, okay, whatever. At least I know where I'm going. And that's a lot when you live with my dad. You know, so I never had any formal religion. So when I came in here and the big God thing and blah, 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 you know, and my deal is I had a lot of issue with God. You know, if there's a God, how come he lets a drunken dad do this to daughters? You know, what is that about? Where is God when all of this evil stuff is going on and the mean stuff and wonderful people die or get killed in car crashes or babies and blah, blah, blah. You know, and what I know today is those are all my excuses for not even going there. You know, because if you're looking for a reason not to do something, it is so easy here. You don't even freaking get credit for it, okay? That's how easy it is to do that here. So, but my sponsor worked diligently with me in the belief of a higher power. And specifically, I had this one group meeting that I was going to, and small group step study. We did the steps every week. There was like about 12 of us. And I maybe, again, in 6-7 months, and that meeting that night went off the step. For my benefit, because they were going to talk about God, and they were all going to share with me the God that they found in the rooms of Al-Anon, in order to help me find a God, because I was not getting there whatsoever, and every single one of those people shared with me from their heart how they found a higher power in the program. And when the meeting was over, my friend Crazy Jean, who led the meeting for my benefit, changed the format of the meeting. And came up to me and he said, "Larsine, you know, did that help you? Is that, you know, getting you, a little bit of a grip about what a higher power is?" And I said, "Gene, I really appreciate all those people sharing with me, you know, but I don't get the God thing. I don't know that I'm ever going to get the God thing." And he said, "You know, Larsine, why God gave you ears?" And I know Gene is a mean person, so and he was being sarcastic to me in the tone that he said it. So I sarcastically said back to him, "Yes, I know, so I can hear what people are trying to tell me." He goes, "Well, in most people's cases, that's true. But in your case, God gave you ears, so you'd have something to hold on to while you pull your head out of your ass." And because that's where I am when I don't want to do stuff. You know, we call it nice words like stubborn or pig-headed or whatever. But really, your head is up your ass, okay, pretty much. And that's really what's going on, and that's why you can't hear. You know, and that day, you know, and because then what Jane went on to say to me is that this is a God-based program. Don't kid yourself. You're not going to get around it any other way. And if you want to know happiness and if you want to know peace, then you have to find that spiritual connection with that higher power or it's not going to happen for you. And we've all worked way too hard on you already to give you up to that. And how grateful I am because they were vested in me. They really and truly were. They cared about me more than I cared about myself. That's what I've learned to do in these rooms. We don't throw anybody away, no matter how big of a pain in the butt they are. We don't. And I'm grateful to know that as well. So that night I went home, went in my backyard, said, "Hello, God, this is Larsine Gantner." Gave him my address and phone number because he don't know where I live. I've never prayed before that I know of, you know, in any kind of meaningful way. But it was the first honest prayer I'd ever said in my life. Because I just said, "God, I don't know where, if you're there, if you're not there. They just tell me that if I don't find you, that I'm not going to make it here. And I really need to make it here. Because I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." And it wasn't just because what I wanted for myself, it's what I saw in you. That cannot be denied. It can't. You go to a meeting. What makes you go to a meeting? What makes you work the steps? What makes you do those things? In Al-Anon, they call it obedience to the unenforceable. And that's really what it is. But I know what makes me do it is I see it work in your life, and it's not a lie. It cannot be denied. There aren't people faking me out or doing whatever here. They're just showing me a different way to live, and they've lived in the same thing I've lived in, and even worse, and even worse. And they're happy, joyous, and free, and they want to pass that on to me. What a gift. What an absolutely, positively wonderful gift. And that's just kind of what's been pounded into me the whole entire time. There's just a couple of stories I'm going to share with you before I sit down. Because my sponsor likes me to share these stories with you because she wants you to know how difficult I am for her to sponsor. And she wants full credit for all of it. And the first one is my son, Earl. And this is my son that's been in, you know, just had a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol. When he was 19 years old, really bad, dark times with him. And, of course, I'm very fearful because what's the worst that can happen? They can die. And it happens. And this happened to lots of my friends and my sister, my dad. I know it can happen. So I'm fearful for this kid. But this particular weekend, I'm at the South Bay Roundup, which is our local convention. My husband and I are very active in it. We know all the people. You know, it's like 2,000 people there and wonderful speakers, workshops. And you come home on Sunday, and you know how you come home from this weekend, and like serenity is coming out of every orifice of your body, you know, and you're just full of the love and the joy and the happiness, and you're just pooping serenity and just coming out of you. And And that was certainly true this weekend. And I'm a disciplined person, you know, and I have an exercise regime that I do weekly. And now I've been gone for 3 days at the Roundup, which means I haven't done my exercise regime, which now means because I have to check it off the list. So I got to do like 26 hours of exercise now. So I can check that crap off that list. And so we get home and I get into my exercise stuff, and I had a treadmill in the garage. So I was going to run on that for a little bit. And next to the treadmill is a weight bench. It's my son's weight bench. You know, and I look at the weight bench, and on the weight bench is a driver's license. It's a woman's driver's license. It has information. I love information. I can tell her birthday. She's 32 years old, and she lives in Glendora, California. I decide in 10 seconds or less, this woman has been in my house. She has had sex with my 19-year-old son. She has two kids, wants to marry him, and call me mom. I am all over this story. Woo, information lands here, you know. So I run in the house. And Butch is laying on the couch, his favorite form of exercise. And I show him the driver's license and nothing, because the man has no imagination whatsoever. He's just, the driver's license. You know, so I tell him what I think happened over the weekend. His eyes roll back in his head like they often do when I tell him what I think happened over the weekend. And he said, call Carol, you know, and you're crazy. So Carol's my sponsor. So anyway, so I call Carol, and Carol agrees with Butch. You know, she's like, you are a whack job. You know, just shut up. Shut up. She goes, another thing, I know you are afraid for that kid. I know you are. She says, but you making up more crap to heap on a plate that's already got enough on it is not necessary. She says, you know what, it takes just as much time to think good thoughts for this kid as it does negative ones. So why don't you pray for him and think good thoughts for him? You know, and I end my conversation as I often do with my sponsor, because I've been coming for a long time. Never mind. You know, I mean, I just need to be reminded to get back on the path, why it's so important for me. And I don't know what it was, 2 or 3 days later, I don't see Earl because of his work, school, and drug schedule, you know, and my work schedule. And 3 days later, he comes in with a driver's license, and he walks up to me, and he says, Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license? Well, I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license. That's a bad example. That's bad, bad, bad example. Somebody going to meetings, working the steps, sponsoring people, being of service, all of that stuff. You know, people say to me, why do you keep coming to Al-Anon, Larsine? 10 seconds alone keeps me coming back day after day after day after day. Because I am hardwired to think that way. I will think the worst of any situation. At this given moment, I will. But I take it to you and you show me a different way to look at it. And you give me hope. And that's just, and then I get the shot at a good life. If I so choose to take it, I can be in the misery or not be in the misery. Now it's been 11 years ago I found out I was going to be a grandma, and I'm excited. My son's been married a few years. I'm waiting and waiting, and finally they're going to have this baby, and I'm so excited. And, you know, and now they have the popsicle stick, so you know the baby's coming when it's coming, because they got the stick that tells them that stuff right away. And so this baby's going to be born in around May, And I've never had a grandbaby before. I don't have a card in my head about a grandbaby, so I make one up on the spot. And first thing on that card is, I have to be there when the baby's born. Don't ask me, this man's here, goes on the card. It's got to get checked off once it's on the card. And so I have to be there when the baby's born. Okay, fine. So in May, this is 9 months now, I have a lot of commitments around May that are going to take me away like 3 or 4 weekends in a row there. So my husband says to me, maybe you better get out of those commitments if you're going to be here when the baby's born. Now, when the alcoholic is the voice of reason in your house, you ought to just chuck it, okay? Just give it up. So he suggested I talk with Carol about it. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I consider sponsors to be plan busters when you have a plan, and I definitely had a plan. And so I wasn't going to tell her my plan because I know she'd just pick it apart. And I can't share it with my home group because they'll rat me out to my sponsor. They're no good either. So I go right to God. I go right to that God that I found in my little backyard that day, you know, because I have a very tight connection with my higher power today. I have a great deal of faith. And I go to God and I just say, you know, God, this baby's, I know you're not supposed to ask for specific things. I know that. But I'm asking for a baby to be born, which is not like asking for shoes or a car, okay? And when you find yourself in prayer rationalizing and justifying why you should be getting what you want in prayer, you know, again, that's not going to work. It's just not going to work. But it's something I desperately wanted was just for this baby not to be born on the weekend. So I reminded God of the service that I do. And totally Rationalizing and justifying. Mind you, this is 23 years in Al-Anon. Okay, this is why my sponsor wants you to tell you this story, because it ain't about getting well. It's about doing it one day at a time the best you can. And so, you know, and there's 9 months goes by, you know, and now I'm doing these commitments, you know, not that I didn't have others, but this was a big glom of them in this particular part of May. And so I do all my commitments, last one. I'm gone these 3 weekends in a row, fourth weekend in a row. I call my daughter-in-law Friday morning, nothing happening, not even a peep. Great, I'm back on Sunday, I'm home free. I'm like in freaking Nebraska or someplace. And I'm at this dinner, and my cell phone rings, and the baby has been born. I'm pissed, okay? This is not an awe moment. This is a pissed moment. And, you know, and those people say, oh, we're so happy you're here. You know, and I'm like, I hate you people, you know. And of course, that doesn't come out. The smiley face comes out. But I know I have tools. I excuse myself from the room. I go out. I call my sponsor on my cell phone. I tell her I'm quitting Al-Anon. This sucks. I ask God for one little weenie baby not to be born on one freaking weekend. Do I get my prayer answered? No. And I'm so angry. I'll never forget this. And I'm so upset. I am hurt, hurt, hurt. And my sponsor says, I'll have to call you back. Oh, thank you. Thank you, sponsor. Thanks for being there for me. Now, I don't know how long it was, a minute or 2 minutes. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure how it is here in Atlanta, but I'm telling you, in Southern California, when your sponsor calls you, you have crossed the line. Because I answered the phone, and it was my sponsor. And what I know is I had freaked out my sponsor so bad, she had to call her sponsor because she didn't know what the frick to do with me. So then it's her sponsor on the phone, and I hear her sweet voice. And it's, you know, Larsing, did you turn your will and your life over to the care of God today? And I, you know, and I'm here to tell you, no matter how busy I've been in my life, no matter what I think is going on or whatever, I learned that right out of the gate too, again, from the people that I landed in such a good group who taught me that. You know, you can turn your will and your life over to the care of God every single day in like 3.1 seconds. It doesn't take that much time. There is no excuse not to do that. And I had done it that day, and I told her that I had. And she said, then you are exactly where you are supposed to be, doing exactly what you are supposed to be doing. And because you made some ridiculous rule in that silly head of yours about how this was supposed to go down, you're going to take this beautiful moment, the day you became a grandmother, and turn it into a piece of crap? Never mind. Hang up the phone. Hang up the phone one more time. And now what I remember now is my husband picking me up from the airport on Sunday, taking me to the hospital and holding that beautiful baby boy in my arms. That's my memory. Left to my own devices, 23 years in here, I'd have made it be a piece of crap. Because I made some rule about how it's supposed to go down. You know, 7 years ago I got a granddaughter on a Wednesday. Thank you very much. God hears your prayers, he just answers them when he feels like it. So, you know, and then the last, you know, this last little bit, you know, my husband 10 years ago, he got diagnosed with, it's been like 11 or 12 now, diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver when he was 24 years sober, you know, is because of hepatitis C. And so we've been doing this battle for like 11, 12 years. He just now finished number 4 treatment with interferon and ribavirin. Plus they stuck the new stuff in there, the Sovaldi, which is supposed to be this big giant cure. So, you know, it's just been a rough road. We just had our 40th wedding anniversary in April, and we went to Hawaii, and we took our kids and our grandkids with us, which was fabulous. My husband was halfway through treatment, so the interferon and the ribavirin does not agree with him. He's very icky when he's on that stuff, and here I made this big plan. It's our 40th anniversary. We're in Hawaii, and I'm here with interferon head over here, and you know, not going the way I wanted it to go or whatever, feeling sorry for myself, you know, and so I call my sponsor. And it's like, you know, it's just not what I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be so much more. You know, this is a thing for us to really get to share. You know, and then she reminded me, you know, his life might be being saved right this very moment because he's doing this thing. You know, but again, I want to make it be about me. I'm really no different than the alcoholic. But I take it to my sponsor and she shows me a different way to look at it. You know, and what I had that day was an absolutely fabulous day. We ended up going on this dinner cruise with our kids and our grandkids, and this freaking humpback whale came, waved his little finny thing at us, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, how big of a sign from God do I need? I need a humpback whale. I'm telling you, sometimes that's what I need. You know, and I want to thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for being my humpback whale. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.